The Athletic.
Totally Football Show today. Internationals, drag and drop. Wales become the only people doing worse with the polls than the Tories, while Georgia and Ukraine book their trips to Germany. While at Wembley, England and Belgium. Belgium homage to Hergé, and appropriately, with everyone drawing nicely. We'll run up all the international news, and they get onto Premier League match day 30 and the superest of Sunday set twos, Man City Arsenal. All that and more in this Totally Football Show. Thursday, the 28th of March. Listener, thank you so much for joining us here on the Totally Football Show. Charlie Eccleshare of The Athletic is with us. Charlie.
Hello.
Nice to see you. Benji Lagnardo of, remind me where you're from, Benji.
That's Pickfair, pickfair.com.
Like it Jimbo. Says on your T-shirt.
As it does.
Tom Williams is here. Hey,
hello,
Tom.
James. Hello.
All right. Tom's back from his evening with Wales and gnashing of teeth. Tom, so sorry about how it turned out on Tuesday. The bitterest way for you to miss out.
Yeah, I mean, penalty shootouts, obviously pretty painful.
Mm.
And also just, I don't know, you just makes you realise what a cruel thing sport is.
Yeah.
And what a cruel sport football is in particular, that after, you know, 120 minutes of deadlock, it all boils down to one poor unfortunate soul,
yeah,
Dan James, not scoring a penalty.
Well, yeah.
And, you know, Welsh dreams were dashed.
So they were. Benji, have you got any words? Any words of comfort for Tom?
Yeah. I thought, considering this was the first sort of tournament run post-Gareth Bale, it's pretty decent to get to where you got to. Were Welsh fans expecting that, or were they expecting to get there at the beginning of the campaign?
I think that the bar has been raised so high in recent years that there's an expectation that Wales will be in the mix for automatic qualification. They weren't drawn in a particularly difficult group, and they didn't make a great fist of it. Obviously, you know, no Gareth Bale and no Aaron Ramsey, although he was fit on Tuesday, means that you don't have those sort of magician footballers who can get you out of a hole on their own. But, you know, some of Wales' recent performances, you know, we beat Croatia in October, who are one of the best teams in the world, very convincing against Finland last week. I think, and also, you know, it is easier to qualify for European Championships than it was before they expanded the tournament. We knew that we had the backup policy of a playoff place via the Nations League. So, you know, in the wider context of the Welsh national team, getting this close is a decent effort. But I think because we've, you know, almost got used to qualifying in recent years.
And you were that close as well. You were one kick from glory.
Well, in actual fact, Rob Page has said this a couple of times, that we were one kick away. But technically speaking, we were at least two kicks away.
At least two kicks, right. Yeah.
But you can kind of, you can see where he's coming from.
Question. When you are watching a penalty shootout and the thing you don't want to happen happens, this is on telly, sorry, Tom, I know you were there. So I immediately turn off. Like, as soon as I saw Dan James's face, and it's like horrible when you see the face of this guy whose world is just collapsing in on himself, right? I don't want to see anything else then. Turn it off. I know some people that are like, no, I want to sit there and absorb and watch the pain. You're a sicko, Jimbo.
I was just going to ask the question, whether, do you think ever during a penalty shootout when it goes the wrong way, any of those players, including possibly even the person who's taken it, thinks, oh, I've got the summer off?
No. I don't think it's an immediate thought, but there are, you know, some players dislike going to big tournaments, being away from home for, you know, weeks on end.
Or some might have a wedding or something that they were like, now I get to go to that wedding. That
one thing I would say is that if you scored your penalty in the shootout, it was quite notable that, like when Nico Williams scored his penalty, I thought he was going to be the one to miss, by the way, but when he scored his, and he sort of was going back to the halfway line like with a big smile on his face.
100%. I thought exactly the same thing. And because Chesney's trying to psych him out and he deals with that really well, I do think he could probably sleep quite well that night knowing, like, I did put mine away.
And usually, if you miss a penalty, it's not the end of the world, unless you happen to be the guy who's lost. But because it had been 9 good penalties, 5 perfect Polish ones and 4 good ones from Wales, so it was down to the first one that gets missed is out.
And that, I think, was what was particularly unfortunate. And as you know, because you know, when you're watching the game, you have no idea who's going to take the next penalty until they start the walk towards the penalty area. And as soon as I thought it was Dan James, obviously you're thinking, don't miss, because you think that for every player who goes up. But for Dan James in particular, who is such a curious footballer, like remarkable physical attributes, one of the fastest footballers in the world, but the thing, the stick that is used to beat him, you know, time and time again, is lack of composure. And, you know, when the pressure's off, he can do it. And he scored a beautifully taken goal against Finland at the same end of the ground in front of the Canton stand last Thursday. Robs the centre-back, rounds the keeper, slots it in, 4-1 through to the final. Everyone's very happy. And so for a player whose composure specifically is repeatedly kind of, you know, zeroed in on, to have his composure tested in those circumstances, yeah. I don't think he'll be sort of, you know, massacred in the press like he might have been if this had been, you know, the 1990s or something. But it's unfortunate for James because he is this kind of sort of perennial nearly man. He does loads of great things. And I think if he's in a really kind of supportive environment, he can be a game-changing footballer. But there is this, oh man, he just doesn't really, occasionally goes to pieces in the penalty area, occasionally makes the wrong decisions.
And this is the most brutal exposing kind of that. Yeah. Why did Brennan Johnson come off when he did?
Brennan Johnson came off because he wasn't having a particularly influential game. I mean, his form for Spurs of late has been brilliant. He's in the best period of his, you know, his nascent career as a Spurs player. But he wasn't having a huge amount of joy. Wales weren't getting the ball to their most creative players in dangerous areas. So Brennan Johnson was pretty quiet. Harry Wilson was pretty quiet. And when Page sent Dan James on for Johnson, there was no sort of sense of, oh, you know, what's he doing? Because I think Wales fans know what Dan James can do, and he can be a game-changing figure. What was slightly curious with regards to the substitutions was that about 15 minutes after James came on for Johnson, and that was like for like, James just played off Kiefer Moore, who was the lone striker, Page had to take off Connor Roberts, who was playing right wing back, and he sent on David Brooks. And I thought, oh, okay, well, he's going to switch to a back four now. He'll move Nico Williams, who is a right back by trade, over to the right hand side from left wing back. Ben Davis will move out to left back, and you'll have slightly more attacking players around Kiefer Moore. But he didn't. He put Dan James at right wing back, which meant he was just a million miles away from Kiefer Moore. Mm. And Poland had an awful lot of the ball in extra time, so there was space in behind them that Wales could have potentially exploited. But the fastest player was spending all his time tracking Poland's left wing back towards his own goal.
In the aftermath, have you begun to kind of think back about why Wales let it get to a penalty shootout? Wales looked the better side, don't
you? I mean, I thought they were two very evenly matched sides, okay. Two quite unspectacular sides, like very solid. I mean, yeah, Poland didn't have a shot on target in 120 minutes. Not that Wales had, you know, that many themselves. It wasn't like Wales created chance after chance to put the game to bed. Poland were kind of constantly keeping them at arm's length. And it was one of those games that just felt like it was heading to penalties once you got to about the 70th minute. So I think the regrets in this campaign are with regard to losing at home to Armenia last summer, drawing against Armenia late on in the qualifiers. Those were the games that really sort of torpedoed Wales's chances. And, you know, even despite beating Croatia, which was a phenomenal result, they weren't able to build on that. So there is a sense that I think Wales and Wales's players and Wales's coaching staff, they don't get the free pass they might have got in years gone by when we weren't used to qualifying for things.
On the plus side, you were rubbish at the World Cup, so Poland might be a better component for this.
Yeah, coming going to a really tough group as well.
Yeah, I mean, we were awful at the World Cup, and we have missed out on a pretty terrifying group with France, Netherlands, and Austria. Ralf Rangnick's reborn Austria. But Wales have looked a lot better, and the kind of post-Bale, I hesitate to say post-Ramsey transition because he's still there, although the suggestions he might be about to announce his international retirement. But this team has moved on since the World Cup. You don't look at them and think, oh, if only Gareth Bale was there. They're capable of winning matches without him. So I feel like had
third and go through the group.
Yeah.
So it's not,
So I feel like had we qualified, we wouldn't have stunk the place out quite as much as we did in Qatar. But, I guess will never know.
Who will you be rooting for this summer?
Having a book about French football that comes out,
have you, Tom?
2 months before the tournament, it would probably be helpful for me if France either win it okay. or have a complete meltdown. Everyone turns on each other and they go out, really? Go out in the group phase. So as long as it's not a kind of meek quarterfinal exit, I will, you know, I'll
Tom's
take it.
Book, Va Va Voom, The Modern History of French Football, will be available on April 25th.
Making sure that all the
It's all a really nice cover and a nice spine as well.
Sometimes you should judge a book by its cover.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, one should not judge a book by its cover, as we know. But if you want to,
that's a good
before you've had a chance to read it and you like the cover, then, you know,
it's going to look good on your bookshelf, which is
judge away.
Half the job of a book, I'm going to suggest.
What do you think, Tom's the over or under during the tournament for a tweet of sort of like enjoying watching France play? Why not tuck into this book of it? It's hard.
There probably will be some. I think as long as you do it in a self-deprecating way. Yeah.
Oh, that's not been tried.
Yeah, yeah. That's the sweet spot.
Nah, you've got to hit. Just full sales.
Said the man in the Pickfair T-shirt.
Well, exactly.
It's true.
What are you trying to hide? Sell your books.
All right. Well, you know what? There were other international matches that took place this midweek. For a start, there were two more finals for places at Euro 2024. Georgia picked up one of them, beating Greece after a similarly goalless 120 minutes. They then went to penalties. They won 4-2 on spot kicks, claiming thus their first ever major tournament place. Woohoo! Which is a nice bit of variety. Hmm. They're in a group with Portugal, Turkey, and the Czech Republic. So, not easy. Ukraine also will be at Germany 2024. They came from behind to beat Iceland 2-1. In their final, Genoa's Albert Gudmundsson opened the scoring. He's in some rare form. 4 goals in 2 internationals for Iceland over the last week or so. But then Ukraine came back with a gorgeous curling shot from Viktor Sagankov. And then, Mudryk out of Chelsea got the winner late on. And there was much rejoicing. They go into the group of Belgium, Slovakia and Romania. And given the huge numbers of Ukrainian folk who've moved across because of the Russian invasion to Germany, they've taken in, I think, more refugees than any other nation than the Germans. They will probably have their games will probably have quite the home atmosphere.
And they're probably going to be everyone's second team, aren't they?
Would hope.
Yeah.
Maybe Tom's first team.
Oh, see, Thomas, you're selfishly plugging your book.
I am in the market for
a
team. So
poor old Ukraine.
It's a pretty presentable looking group as well. Mm. I mean, you definitely back them to get through that.
Belgium, Slovakia and Romania.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay. What else happened in internationals? Listener, we'll be rounding up the rest of the big headlines next.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally. This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
So Euro 2024 host Germany continued their recent bounce under Julian Nagelsmann after beating France the other day. They then had themselves a comeback 2-1 victory over the Netherlands. Bart Verbruggen did his best to hold the Germans at bay. The Brighton keeper, he looked very good, but they were too strong. Maximilian Mittelstadt with a lovely shot to equalise after his error had led to Joey Vermaan volleying in early doors. And then Füllkrug, who can't stop scoring as well, headed in a winner in the 85th minute. Stop me if you wanted to leap in because you really enjoyed any of these games. France, who, as I mentioned, were beaten by Germany last weekend, also came from behind. They beat Chile 3-2, a game which featured, probably, Tom, you were across this in some way, shape or form because you're a big expert on French football and its modern history. Did you appreciate Randal Kolo Muani's performance in the match?
Yeah, I mean, that was the big sort of question mark going into this international break, was whether Marcus Thuram and or Randal Kolo Muani would succeed in making a case for a starting place at the World Cup, because I think the feeling is that Olivier Giroud is probably not going to go into this tournament as France's first choice striker. Thuram didn't have a great game against Germany, although, you know, France on the whole didn't really show up. But yeah, Kolo Muani was man of the match against Chile, and he's had a pretty tough time of it since he joined PSG last summer. I mean, unexpectedly, Luis Enrique decided that he was going to start using Kylian Mbappe as his first choice centre forward. Bradley Barcola has emerged as first choice on the left hand side. You've got Ousmane Dembele on the right hand side, and so Kolo Muani is like barely gets a game for PSG, but Didier Deschamps really likes him. And I think he likes his, you know, he's got a slightly atypical profile. You know, he can be a number nine, he can play wide. He's got pace, he's got creativity, and he showed both sides of that against Chile, heads in the goal that puts France 2-1 up from Mateo Hernandez cross, and then fantastic assist for Olivier Giroud to tap in the third goal. And Kolo Muani is quite unusual as a modern footballer in that he is a right-footed attacking player who prefers to play on the right rather than on the left. So he doesn't want to be kind of cutting in, you know, like curling in, as so many, you know, right-footed, left-sided modern players do. He's quite happy, you know, kind of ploughing a furrow, a bit like Brennan Johnson. Yeah, and you know, the assist for Giroud sort of exemplified that perfectly. So I think that was the main kind of take-home for France over the international break. Really disappointing performance against Germany, shaky performance against Chile. They're letting in loads and loads of goals at the moment. Important players sort of underperforming. Antoine Griezmann wasn't available and was badly missed, but at least Kolo Muani is showing that he, you know, he might be an option for the Euro.
Interesting. San Marino, did they win? No. They played, though, against St. Kitts and Nevis, or Nevis, depending upon your preference. They drew this time. So, baby steps. Ooh, Liechtenstein, Latvia. Did you see the remarkable opening goal in that? 14 seconds into the match, Latvia defender Marcus Oss decides to pass back to his keeper. He's pretty much on the goal line himself. Somehow he slots it into his own goal because the keeper's gone wandering off the other way. But yeah, 14 seconds in, what a way to begin a match.
Very, very entertaining, yeah. Seek that out if you haven't seen it.
Also very entertaining was Spain-Brazil. That finished 3-3. Spain, again, conceding, but looking really impressive going forward. Yamal was fantastic. Danny Olmo's goal was absolutely magnificent as well. Your fella, Lucas Paquetar, with a penalty really late on, to earn the, well, it wouldn't be a point, but yeah, to earn a draw. Endrick came off the bench and scored a brilliant goal. That's 2-2 for the young teenager. I just think he's got a future ahead of him.
You've always said it.
I've always said it. And yeah. Oh, and also England drew with Belgium. Woo!
Which I quite enjoyed.
Did you quite enjoy that, Charlie?
There was loads going on.
There was.
I mean, England were shaky defensively, created loads.
Yeah.
It wasn't one of, you know, often traditionally England friendlies, there's not a lot happening. But in this one, there was.
Okay. Four goals. two defensive howlers, yeah, setting up Yuri Tielemans, to paraphrase Cat Stevens. It was two for the Tielemans.
Very good, yeah.
But then you had
an incredible cross, that Lukaku. Oh, really sensational. Gorgeous, yeah.
Yeah.
He had done before. For, there was a clip circulating him doing it before for Everton. Similar kind of cross.
Yeah.
And there's something about a diving header, a back post diving header like that in the rain. It just kind of...
Yeah, lovely.
Just kind of...
Elevates it.
Elevates it a couple of notches.
Generally for England, though, I thought England were great. I thought there were loads of positives to come out of this game. And I think, you know, obviously the last minute equaliser from Bellingham puts a nice gloss on it, so no one's moaning afterwards.
First, yeah, that'll stop him.
Well, I think it kind of has. Like, there would have been a lot of nonsense about two losses in a row, despite the fact that England were very, very... They were much better than Belgium in this game. And some positives to come out of it. Kobbie Mainoo, I think now it's very hard to argue that he doesn't start for England. Like, he basically showed in this game against top opposition that he can do a bit of everything, like everything that we need from that role. He's, you know, he can tackle, he can play the simple pass when he needs to, he can burst into space when it's available. He's more sort of dynamic than Henderson. He's more disciplined than Conor Gallagher. He's got to start. And he was man of the match against a top five team. So yeah, absolutely brilliant. There are other positives. I thought Tony,
right,
he's sort of, I think over these two games, has won the battle of who is
the backup striker.
Just because he's much more Harry Kane shaped. He can drop deep and hold the ball up. He's not as much of a front foot striker as Watkins, but that's not what Kane is. And if the team is kind of built around a Harry Kane, I think it's got to now be Ivan Toney in the awful situation that Kane doesn't play, and penalties.
I was going to say, yeah, it could be useful for a shootout.
We are, exactly. If you want to win a tournament these days, it's pretty likely you're going to have to get through a shootout. So yeah, I think Toney definitely played his way into it. And there were other
Jared
positives.
Bowen
really
well.
Good. Really, I'm very, very proud of him, Jimbo.
Yeah.
Because he hasn't had that game for England yet. He's looked okay, but he was really good. And I think, again, has put his name down as the number one replacement for Saka. And that's probably ahead of Cole Palmer, by the way, which some people might not like. And Chilwell was much better. He was a bit dodgy against Brazil. So yeah, loads of positives. Because Chilwell, again, he will play some part in the Euros because, sure, even if he's fully fit, isn't going to last a full tournament.
Is this, by contrast, the last time we'll see Lewis Duncan in England shirt?
Oh, it's really sad because he actually wasn't that bad apart from that mistake. And the problem, this is one of the only negatives to come out of this. If yes, he was the one to flunk the audition, well, then there's a question mark over who is the number one guy to replace Harry Maguire if he's not fit. And I think we should have at least had a look at Branthwaite over the two games.
That was weird.
It was weird. Like, why call him up if you're not even going to have a look at him? The next two games England plays after the squad announcement.
Right.
Because I think that
Bosnia and Herzegovina is one, is that right?
It's the big ones. Bosnia and Iceland.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that if Stones is injured, I think the natural next in line is Guehi. But Guehi, again, he's had knee surgery. I'd be very, very worried about taking him to a Euros if he's barely played. Then there's Colwill, maybe, who's another natural replacement for Stones.
Gomez.
Do you want Gomez at centre-back starting in a Euros? I don't think you do.
Of the people at the back, what about Ben White after Declan Rice said that he and Aaron Ramsdale are going to have a word?
I mean, Rice's full quotes, though, were... He sort of said a bit of everything, and that he also said... It's kind of up to him. I don't know the ins and outs of it, but yes, we'll speak to him. But I think that ship has sailed. Holland is, as much as Gareth Southgate might insist, nothing to do with Steve Holland. All the reporting suggests it absolutely is to do with Steve Holland. So I think that ship sailed, which is a real shame because I think it's overshadowed. He is very, very good.
Remember a few years ago, somebody made, like, there was this kind of absolute glut of right backs, and someone made the right back at English 11. It's funny that fast forward like a couple of years and we got Ezri Konsa playing at right back.
Yeah.
Who I'm pretty sure wasn't on it in that 11. Like, that is a major caveat to the two goals that we conceded in this game. Like, a back four of, what was it? Gomez who came on.
Yeah.
Konsa, Dunk, and Chilwell. Like, that is probably not even our second choice, back four. So that, I think forgives the two goals.
In Konsa's defence, he's been playing at right back quite regularly for Villa this season and doing really well. And England don't have a glut of options at centre back. You know, you kind of look at the team every time Harry Maguire is starting and think, how is Harry Maguire still starting? You look at the other options and there aren't all that many.
I wonder whether... I thought he was brilliant last season at Brighton and just... hasn't Cole really kicked on.
Gray, Dunk, there's now maybe a question mark. But Branthwaite, I think, is, you know, just to slightly repeat myself, like he reminds me so much of when Harry Maguire was coming through at Hull. Like his emergence this season at Everton, Branthwaite, he's got all of those things that really brilliant younger Harry Maguire had. So he's just the natural next in line, I think. But I think it will still, I think Dunk is still probably ahead of him just because of his
seniority. What are the brilliant things of a young Harry Maguire?
Young Harry Maguire at Hull was really, really good. The same as the young Harry Maguire at Leicester was really, really good.
Yeah, but so what were the...
Dominant in the air, fantastic and aggressive at set pieces, surprisingly calm when advancing with the ball. He still kind of is. It's just he hadn't built up this body of errors that we now slightly associate Harry Maguire with. You know, don't forget, Man United paid 80-odd million for him for a reason. He was... one of the best kind of young to, you know, middling.
Wasn't the reason.
But I mean, I remember like early Harry Maguire when he was at Sheffield United and Hull. The thing that stood out the most was how much he would get on the ball and just go for it.
Yeah. Right.
Just barrel through teams.
Right.
And it was a very unusual thing to see from an English centre-back. And what's notable now is that when, you know, on the rare occasions where he allows himself a forward foray with the ball at his feet, he looks really cumbersome. Like there was a clip that did the rounds on Twitter a little while ago. He'd found himself on the left wing during a United game. It was like, what is Harry Maguire doing? It's like the polar bear in Arkansas or whatever that does the rounds every now and again. But that was like a big part of his game. Are you not familiar with this?
Polar bear in Arkansas.
It's like a meme. It's a picture of a polar bear.
Yeah.
And the caption is like, what the hell is a polar bear doing in Arkansas or something? Right. And every now and again, people will use it when something unexpected happens in sport.
And that's Harry Maguire on the left wing?
That's what it looks like now. But I mean, that used to be his natural game.
Okay.
Sorry, they've got, what is a polar bear doing in Arlington, Texas?
Not that Arkansas. Makes more sense. Sorry. Down south.
Sorry. Okay. Get your memes right.
Very brief word on Belgium. What did you make of them?
Yeah, I don't think they'll be... I don't think they're one of the big favourites at the Euros. I thought they were good in parts, but I also thought England created a huge amount against them. And they've
been way better.
God, Tom.
But Belgium, no.
Yeah, I mean,
not for you, Charlie.
I think, you know, they've got players playing there like Jan Vertonghen, who, you know, incredible career as a whole.
Yeah.
But, you know, if we're sort of complaining about Harry Maguire and, you know, as being a bit past his best, then...
My penalty, Tony just completely exploited him, you know.
Indeed. Let's move on, because next up, we're going to hit that Premier League Matchday 30.
This is the Totally Football Show, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Welcome back, Premier League. It's been too long, right? Hasn't it, Tom?
It feels like it has been a long time. Well, it has been a long time since we had a full round of Premier League fixtures, because the last Premier League games pre-international break were on that weekend that also had all the FA Cup quarterfinals, many of which were,
I mean, that's,
you know, very high-profile games.
Got coming up, Saturday lunchtime, feast your eyes on Newcastle-West Ham. At 3, scan the internet for news of Chelsea-Burnley, Sheffield United-Fulham, Nottingham Forest, Crystal Palace, Bournemouth, Everton and Spurs Luton. At 5:30, why not enjoy the Midlands stylings of Aston Villa Wolves with your tea before at 8 p.m. setting down some Brentford, Manchester United. 8 p.m. though. How are the away fans going to find... Oh yeah, no, that's okay. Ha 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 ha. Yeah. Two games on Sunday. At 2, Liverpool face Brighton. And at 4:30, yes. Let's just get straight to it. Man City Arsenal, which is... I just think is quite important.
It has that feeling.
The big three, you will recall, separated by just 1 point. And this is the last of the head-to-head meetings between your Arsenal, your Liverpool, your Man City. Arsenal, who've been very much the dominant team when they faced the other sides. A couple of draws and victories. Whether they beat Man City already, they beat Liverpool, drew as well with Liverpool.
Whereas the other teams have, in Arsenal's case, taking the maximum points off each other when they played each other. City and Liverpool drew both times. So yeah, they've done well out of these big games.
All right.
It's huge. I mean, especially as this... So beating City in the league was the big thing Arteta hadn't done. And then they beat them in October. But then the really big thing is going to the Etihad and getting anything, getting close. So they've played them 4 times under Arteta. Lost 3-0, 1-0, 5-0 and 4-1. That one goal was a late consolation. So that's an aggregate 13-1 they've lost these games. And this equivalent fixture last year settled the title. They got battered. And so it does feel like, well, how far have you come? This is such a good test and a chance to see where they are relative to City.
What do you think the difference might be about this Arsenal this time?
Well, I think Rob Holding not playing centre-back and them having Saliba there is enormous as a difference. There is also a feeling that whereas then they were completely running out of gas and exhausted physically and mentally, this time they've paced themselves a bit better, dare I say, in a slightly City-esque way. That's very much been Arteta's aim, that rather than last year peaking really early and then faltering to do more what Guardiola City do or what Fergie's United used to do. Their squad generally is stronger, assuming there aren't injuries from the international break. And if Martinelli's fit, they'll actually have players they can bring off the bench. And they're so much better off the ball. I mean, the big thing in this game last year, Partey, who looked spent, was just, De Bruyne was just running through him. Their big issue last season was off the ball. So they went and spent 105 million on one of the best off the ball players in the world and also brought in Kai Havertz for a lot of money, and he's very good off the ball. So that's going to be, in theory, the big difference, that they won't be steamrolled through the middle like they were last season.
Okay. Going back to Kai Havertz, who's in rare form at the moment, scoring four in his last four Premier League games, a couple of visits, and has a bit of history with Man City as well.
Yeah.
What's been the difference about that, and why would he be so key in terms of them beating the press or what?
Yeah, that's a huge part. I mean, he started actually up front for Arsenal in the Community Shield against City and did really well. He's far better in the air, obviously, than, you know, Gabriel Jesus is quite good in the air for someone of his size, but he's 5'9". Havertz is 6'4" and good in the air. They can beat that press, go direct to him. That's what they did in that game. Obviously, he's got the Champions League final goal against them, but things have really changed. You know, he's basically had to go and play as the number nine because Jesus has been out for most of this eight-game winning run. And they've looked really good doing that. And he gives them a lot off the ball as well. He works really hard. Him and Odegaard often play almost as like two tens up front is the system. So, that is the idea that if City are pressing them, they have that out ball. I think Martinelli being fit or not is massive because City do leave those big spaces in behind.
Is he fit?
We don't know. I mean, he's been out for a little while with a deep cut to his foot. So I think that hit him and Walker, if one of them's out, that's massive for either team. But I think Arsenal will look at, you know, City played United recently and obviously they won and they were far the better side. But there were a lot of times where Marcus Rashford's running in behind, and if they'd had a bit more composure, there were chances there. City are not as formidable defensively as they've been in most of the previous season, few seasons.
Sounds like you're making Arsenal.
Well, no, I think there's. I think it will be close. I think City will. I think Arsenal will push City to play at a level they maybe haven't done this season. I think it's going to be really high quality, really high level, and I think City might just about come through it. But I don't think it'll be like anything like that 4-1 game last season.
Okay. I mean, it's easier to make a case for Arsenal going into this game than it has been any time in recent years. One of the big evolutions in Arsenal's football this season has been the extent to which they control their matches. You go back to that game at the Emirates in October when they beat City, albeit it took a deflected shot from Martinelli right at the end of the game. But they restricted City to a single shot on target. And when they beat Liverpool at the Emirates in February, it was the same again, a single shot on target for Liverpool. So there is a greater sort of control to their game. And also form-wise, okay, City have been winning games, but they haven't been particularly impressive. And, you know, we used to talk about teams being in title-winning form. Arsenal's form this year, 8 straight wins, some ridiculous scorelines, you know, 5-0 against Palace, 6-0 against West Ham, apologies Benji, 5-0 at Burnley, 6-0 at Sheffield United, put 3 goals past Liverpool, past 4 goals past Newcastle. They're beating every team that comes up against them. And, you know, we have this idea of Arsenal as being a fundamentally slightly vulnerable team. And this goes back to, you know, sort of the last days of the Wenger era. And because they had an Arsenal-style collapse this time last season, you can imagine it happening again. And they had a big wobble, you know, this season. At the end of December, they looked absolutely spent. You know, a couple of defeats to West Ham, notably. Yeah. Just, you know, the yin and yang of the West Ham supporter experience. And then at Fulham, and they looked done. And since then, they've looked sensational.
Warm weather training.
Warm weather training, that'll help. And yeah, this thing, you know, Havertz playing through the middle, which was not I don't think what Arteta had in mind when he first signed him. I think his vision was that he would be one of the number eights.
Yeah.
And he's pushed him. And I think it was the Liverpool game in February that we saw that, you know, for the first time during this recent run of games. And it's worked brilliantly. So, yeah, I think City would still be favourites because it's City. But in terms of form, in terms of momentum, in terms of the way that Arsenal have progressed as a team over the last 12 months, I think they'll go into this with more realistic hopes of victory than for a long time.
Quick note, Havertz doesn't feel like a 6'4" player, does he? Like some players seem shorter than they are. Is it because he's a bit skinny and he's slopey shouldered?
Jorginho talked about this actually. He said it's misleading because I think his demeanour, there's almost like a bit of the Ozil sort of demeanour about him. He can feel a bit
languid.
A bit languid and like he doesn't care. From what Jorginho was saying, he's a lot kind of tougher and harder than he appears. He gets a lot of...
Harry Maguire's 6'4". You don't think of Havertz as being the same size as Harry Maguire.
Havertz for me is quite ghostly.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I quite kind of knock-kneed. His way of running. Despite occasionally...
Sickly child.
A sickly child. But if a ball is fired into Havertz, you think one of two things is going to happen. He's going to either hit his knee and bounce out for a throw-in, or he's going to produce this like gossamer touch.
Yeah, he can.
That'll have the entire stadium off their feet. And I think that adds to his charm as a footballer.
All right. That's happening Sunday at 4:30. And it's big. How big is the match which precedes it on Sunday, which sees Liverpool entertaining Brighton? Brighton always seem to do well against Liverpool. They famously drew 3-3 at Anfield in De Zerbi's first game in charge. They beat Liverpool 3-0 last season at the Amex as well, knocked them out of the FA Cup. This time around, they've had a bit of an up-and-down campaign, but they did have a 2-2 draw at the Amex back in October with Liverpool.
And I do think this game could slightly change the feel of the City Arsenal game coming just before. If Liverpool were to drop points in that, suddenly for both Arsenal and City, a win becomes a bit less imperative. And I feel a draw might become a bit more likely. Whereas if Liverpool go and smash Brighton, then, you know, I think one of Arsenal or City is thinking like we really kind of need to win this game, or, you know, it becomes that much bigger. But this should be interesting. I mean, Brighton are such a hard team to read. I mean, they just veer, certainly last season and a bit this, veering from really good result to a really terrible one. And so it's hard to know which one will turn out. They've been really unlucky with injuries as well, Brighton.
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens. Meantime, Benji, you've come correct with a bunch of research on Liverpool's physical approach this year.
Yeah, we'll get there. We're going to go into a brief tunnel, but we're going to come out in Liverpool.
Okay.
So going back to international football, sorry, Jimbo. In the Brazil versus England game, I was really... I was really impressed by Brazil's fouling.
Yes.
Because they kept on doing these little
Lucas
fouls.
Because it was Lucas Paquetá.
Yeah, exactly. But they were sort of getting away with it. And at the end of that game, Brazil had committed twice as many fouls as England, but they both got a yellow card each. So for me, everyone was saying, dirty bastards, whatever. I was like, no, this is really clever. This is smart. Like, smart fouling is a really interesting thing. So I did some analysis and looked at the Premier League, players in the Premier League, to try and work out who the best and worst foulers are.
Well, traditionally, it's Rodri, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, no, you'll be surprised. So,
I'm going to be surprised. Listener, stand by for surprises
some definitions to start with. Okay. A good fouler is somebody who commits lots of fouls and gets few yellow cards.
Right. What about Robbie Fowler? How's he?
Robbie Fowler is a player from the 1990s for Liverpool.
Yeah.
And a bad fouler is somebody who doesn't commit many fouls but gets lots of yellows, right? And the baseline is that on average it takes 6 fouls to get a yellow card.
Is that right?
And obviously not like in a single game. If you did 6 fouls in a game,
sick?
Well, because it's often over a number of games. So you do 2 fouls in one game, 2 in the next, 2 in the next, and then in one of those you'll get a yellow card. So 6 is the baseline, right? So I looked at the top 50 best foulers in the league.
Stay with us, listener.
And also, it's much funnier looking at the top 50 worst foulers in the league.
So okay, yeah.
The best foulers in the league. Liverpool had the most players in the top 50.
Right.
So their 7 players in the top 50 have accumulated 147 fouls between them, which has yielded only 5 yellow cards.
Amazing.
That's almost 30 fouls per card. Remember, the baseline is 6, right?
6, yeah.
And the top is actually, it's forwards.
Who are these people?
Well, the smartest foulers are usually forwards because they do...
Yeah, but who are your names, Benji?
Diego Jota, 27 fouls on yellow card. Cody Gakpo, 22 fouls, no yellow cards.
That baby face.
Szoboszlai, 23 fouls, 1 yellow card. More impressive for a central midfielder, I think. He's the best. He's the best midfield. He's better than Rodri and the rest at fouling. And going back to my original thesis, there was only one England player in the entire top 50. One England player. And that was Jared Bowen. Now we turn to the bad fouler.
Jared Bowen
is the only England player in that top 50. Now onto bad foulers. These are people that don't foul much, but yet get yellows. 8 England players in the top 50. 9 if you include Ben White. But the top 2 is really quite funny. So I think anyway. In at number 2, Trent Alexander-Arnold
really
has committed 5 fouls this entire season and picked up 5 yellow cards.
But but hang on a second. Are the yellow cards always for fouling?
Mostly. I couldn't tell that from the data. But this is. But then in at number 1,
right,
wonderfully, is Jack Grealish, who has also committed 5 fouls this season.
And how many fouls he had against
6
him?
Yellow cards.
I wonder if he's produced more yellow cards than he's actually...
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
But looking at the team, so what players were in the list of the worst foulers in the league?
Right.
Chelsea, again. 7 players, same as Liverpool, but in the opposite direction, right?
Oh.
So they have accumulated 128 fouls, these 7 players, and picked up 37 yellow cards. That's 3.5 fouls per yellow card versus Liverpool's 30 fouls per yellow card.
Do you think Pochettino's talked about this, that his players need to stop giving away silly yellows?
Is it something you can teach?
Well, it's kind of a testament to the virtues of gegenpressing. Why do Liverpool commit lots of fouls in areas of the pitch where you're unlikely to get a booking? Yeah, it's because they press so aggressively as soon as they lose the ball. And this is kind of borne out by that.
As well, you think about the City teams the last sort of 10 years, or the Guardiola City teams, they're always doing little fouls.
Yeah, renowned for it.
And it's where you do them.
Completely. Yeah. It's about having a proper...
Anywhere else on the pitch, that would be a foul.
No, but it is having a proper shape. Like, look at someone like United and Casemiro. He's not protected. He's having to cover spaces that are just way too big for him.
Mm.
So he's being exposed. And you saw that actually with Arteta's Arsenal. One of the big things he did was to... You think of that like Emery, late Wenger that you mentioned, and Xhaka's just getting bookings all the time because he's being asked to play in a way that he can't. Once you actually... control the spaces in a better way. Like, I think Arsenal's something mad. Last season, they barely got a red card in the Premier League, whereas for Arteta's first 2 or 3 years at the club, they were the worst for red cards. But once you learn how to play in that City way of not leaving yourself exposed, Liverpool, you can get away with Rodri, Fernandinho, the best in the business.
But also, it's funny that English would, you know, this is predicated on being worried that England weren't good at fouling. It's funny how English football has improved and moved forward in so many different ways. Maybe one, you know, look at our national side. We're really good.
You were saying that loads of England players were in the worst foul.
Yeah, exactly. Right. We're bad at fouling. England need to become good at fouling.
So, which is funny, no? As you say, that's
It's not our reputation.
But then
this is the history of football.
Right.
This is the entire history of football right here. England invents the game and invents all the different aspects of the game.
But
teaches foreigners how to play football and do the other football-related things, and foreigners get better at every single aspect of the game, including fouling, and then England have to relearn.
Doesn't that speak to this idea that we're not cute enough, we're not smart and streetwise enough?
That's exactly what I think it holds up.
That's amazing. It's genuinely mind-expanding and eye-opening. Hasn't left us too much time.
Sorry.
No, but I mean in a good way, because all we would have been doing is just running through... the fixtures that are coming up and suggesting what we think might happen. But it's all just chitter and chatter, isn't it? Those games are going to take place.
Ultimately futile.
It's not raw data, is it?
It's not raw data, you're right. But just in case you would like to hear a word or two on the other matches coming up this weekend, we'll do that next. All right, so kicking things off Saturday lunchtime, Newcastle West Ham. Boy, hasn't the pendulum swung again for West Ham. I remember recently you were in Benji and it was all doom and gloom over in East London, but now you've only lost one of the last 6, scoring loads of goals. You have drawn Bayer Leverkusen in the Europa League, which is challenging.
Hmm.
But by and large, these are good times for the Hammers.
Really simple, Jimbo.
Yeah.
Paquetá.
Yeah.
He was out for 2 months, didn't win a game, got knocked out of the FA Cup by Bristol City. Since he's been back, we're unbeaten in 4 in the Premier League and we smashed Freiburg to get into the quarters of the Europa League. Like, that's kind of it. When you've got him, Bowen and Kudus, probably the best forward line outside of maybe the top 5, probably better than United's. And I had a sort of startling thought the other day that West Ham's forward line is probably worth about £250 million.
Like, £250 million.
In today's market, you could get close to 100.
Exactly. Tom's put his little finger in his mouth.
Yeah. Pagatar and Kudus, you could get close to 100.
Nice. Are you gonna do Newcastle away Saturday lunchtime?
I think we've got a really good chance. We're on good form and they're riddled with injuries.
Riddled.
And no Trippier, which I think really diminishes them as a side. So I think so.
Yeah, I said a couple of weeks ago, Benji, on this podcast, I thought Pagatar was up there with João Paulinho as the player that a team can most not do without. Now, Paulinho, actually, Fulham went and proved me wrong because they won some games without
him.
But Pagatar absolutely has proven that point.
I just think that Pagatar is so important to West Ham. Tom?
He is. Well, I think one of the most enjoyable things about Pagatar is how slow he is. Because at you know, a time when football is quicker than ever, the fact that you've got a guy who basically only has two gears but is still able to just boss things. And I would thought of this watching highlights of the Brazil-England game. She's playing alongside Bruno Guimarães and they were both at Ligue 1. They were both at Lyon, not at the same time, unfortunately for Lyon, but they both arrived and Lyon were like, okay, we've signed these two Brazilian midfielders. And so when someone says Brazilian midfielder, you get an idea in your head, flamboyant, step overs, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, they're two very gritty footballers, Bruno Guimarães. And I think that's one of the reasons why they both had so much success. But they're both extremely slow. And I remember thinking, watching them in Ligue 1, it will be difficult for them to succeed in the Premier League. And once again, what do I know?
His
about
aggression
anything?
Has been the thing that I think surprised the West Ham fans.
Will Bruno Guimarães be featuring for Newcastle?
Yes.
He's fit, isn't he?
I think.
So, he plays. West Ham are currently seventh. A little bit further up the table, you've got Villa, Spurs, and possibly, if you squint a little bit, Man United battling for fourth and fifth. Villa currently in fourth place on 56 points. Spurs are 3 points behind them, but they do have a game in hand. 6 points behind Spurs are Man United. So, yeah, probably a prohibitive margin that.
Yeah, Villa. Yeah, that get that Spurs. Luton game.
You're going to Spurs Luton.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, I mean, history. This is Luton's first visit to Tottenham since November 1991.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie.
Yeah.
Do you remember what happened then?
I do, because we talked about it the other day.
Did you?
View from the Lane.
4-1. 4-1 for Spurs. Gary Lineker scored two, as did substitute Scott Houghton.
Yeah.
Those are the only goals he ever scored for Tottenham. Producer Ben points out that after he hung up his boots, he became a police officer. That's an unusual career path. And he also starred in Cop Squad on Sky. I imagine, was that a kind of police football team type thing, was it?
I mean, it's unfortunate that footballers are no longer obliged to
become posties.
Do jobs after.
To embark upon peculiar secondary careers. I remember Norman Whiteside, former Man United winger, became a podiatrist, became a foot doctor, which makes a lot of sense because, you know, footballers, they do know a lot about feet. They're no strangers to a foot.
Is
that right?
No. Yeah, the Wigan centre-back, Aaron
oh, yeah,
Zayu.
I imagine that plenty of footballers do still take up work after. Anyway, none of this particularly informs our expectations of Spurs-Luton.
One thing of this game, Spurs-Luton.
Thank you, Ben.
So,
yeah.
Is it about fouling?
No, bear with me. And again, we're going into a small tunnel.
Oh, yeah.
I play a fantasy football game that is not like normal sort of muggle fantasy football. It takes in all of the Opta data and forms scores for the players. So, like, it's not just goals, assists, clean sheets. It's like aerials won, it's key passes. It's about 25 different metrics or whatever, and it spits out a score, right?
Mm.
Now, since the turn of the year, the player with the highest score based on this kind of accumulated... the highest score based on this this method is playing in this game. Who do you think it is?
Alfie Doughty?
Close.
Ross Barkley.
It's Ross Barkley. And I feel sort of, I'm sorry not sorry to mention him pretty much every time I come on this podcast. Because but he's having a sensational season. And if Luton stay up, PFA Player of the Year.
They're currently 17th, sandwiched between Everton and Forest.
80. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, points deduction.
Yeah, because of the changes since our last set of fixtures.
But also, going back to the conversation we were having before about England and Kobbie Mainoo now looking like potentially a nailed-on starter because he has such a unique skill set, what he's doing is not that dissimilar to what Ross Barkley is doing at Luton. They're very similar kind of roles. I guess there's a feeling that the boat has left the quay when it comes to Ross Barkley in England. But he's doing similar things.
Ironically, this, as far as I can tell, is the best Ross Barkley there's ever been, right? And ironically, he was getting into the England squad for ages and into the team when he was always sort of almost brilliant. But in fact, no, he never even got to almost brilliant. He was always almost brilliant. But now he's actually a brilliant footballer. And it's sad that now he probably won't get into the team when he was getting into the team when he wasn't as good.
Luton had a phenomenal run, but it's kind of come to a crashing halt, and they haven't actually had a victory since the end of January, that 4-0 over Brighton. They've only picked up 3 points in their last 8 matches.
They've been unlucky in a few of them. 3-0 up at Bournemouth, lest we forget.
And they've had games like in that run, like United at home, where they were pretty unlucky not to get anything. Villa at home, they should have got something.
Mm. Speaking of teams, though, whose form has fallen off dramatically, Charlie, Spurs, whose performance against Fulham, you dubbed the worst you'd ever seen by any football team ever. Oh, no, possibly it was just under Spurs under Ange.
Spurs under Ange, yeah. It's the worst performance of this season.
So what's happened at Spurs?
Well, that was a one. I mean, that was only one game, so...
Okay, but it's not been a good run of form.
They've been in okay form.
Have they?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a little bit up and down, but they'd won their...
They just won at Villa.
Yeah, they'd gone and battered Villa.
Yeah, right.
And they beat Palace just before then. They had lost at Wolves. They beat Brighton. So, yeah, it's been...
Okay.
Yeah, 3 wins, 2 losses from the last 5. Fulham was weird. It kind of came out of nowhere because they had beaten Villa so convincingly. Mm. That felt like a real moment they'd kick on. Mm. Fulham were really good. I mean... But they just ruthlessly exploited Spurs down the flanks where Tottenham can be vulnerable. They invert both their fullbacks, and Fulham were brave. They stuck both their wingers out there. They kept their position. They stayed high, and they just created overloads. They were just happening
also,
all game.
Speaking of Fulham, they've got they're away at Sheffield United this season. Something that jumped out looking at Fulham stats. Anthony Robinson is...
He was superb, by the way,
I think
Spurs.
He's maybe the best left-back in the league this season, or the highest performing. So looking at his stats, I was pretty struck. He's made more interceptions than any other player, more ball recoveries than any other defender. He's third in the list of tackles won. Going forward, he's third in successful take-ons, i.e. beating a man, and third in successful crosses, and he's got 6 assists.
He's got the joint most assists in open play by a defender in the Premier League this season.
Is Soufal the other one, possibly?
Soufal and Trippier. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's sort of esteemed, well, maybe not Soufal, but that's esteemed company. Robinson has been fantastic, and I'm sorry to say this, Fulham fans, just as Andy Robertson at Liverpool is starting to get a few more injuries and possibly declining as a player, I could sort of see him in a Liverpool side, Anthony Robertson. So, yeah, Robinson, sorry.
No, Robertson.
Robinson.
Robinson. Yeah.
Which one are you talking about?
Anthony Robinson.
Replacing...
Andy Robertson.
Andy Robertson.
Right.
No, he was so good. First half, he was, where the press box is at Fulham, he was on my side. Mm. And he was really impressive. And he set up the first goal in that game. So he was born in Milton Keynes and then was part of the Everton youth setup, but represents the state. He's got 40-odd caps for America.
Yeah.
Well, Spurs, if they win that, will pull level with Aston Villa, who at 5:30 on Saturday will host Wolves at Villa Park. Can Villa hang on to that Champions League 4th spot?
I don't think they will.
Because I was wrong about Spurs, but Villa genuinely are on a terrible run of form.
I mean, they looked so cooked in that defeat against Spurs, and that was the real sort of, this is the shootout for fourth place. And it wasn't that long ago that you thought, well, Villa have got this, you know, nailed on because the injury is really biting for Tottenham, and, you know, Man United were in pretty poor form. But ever since, I think the signs were there before, but that game in particular, they were so comprehensively outplayed, and physically they looked so spent that the thought of Villa sort of completely sliding down the table.
And that jump again now. What a silly sausage. That sending off was so stupid.
Yeah, it was. I mean,
he's their captain. He's probably their most, he's arguably, after Watkins, their most important player. And in like the real sort of like, you know, the most important part of the season, he's now just ruled himself out for 3 games.
They go away to City after this as well. I mean, that game against Spurs, not only did they lose, they wiped out their goal difference advantage and lost probably their most important player for 3 games. Pretty bad afternoon.
City next, as you say, and then a couple of games after that is Arsenal. So
yeah, which he'll be back for. But yeah, I mean, they've got big run, and also they're now navigating Conference League knockout ties in amongst Premier League. And that Spurs game was sandwiched in between the 2 Ajax games, and it very much looked like that. And obviously earlier on in the season, when you're in the Conference League, you can manage it, you can heavily rotate.
Their bench,
you can't really do
their
that.
Their bench isn't very strong.
No, and it looked, I mean, in that Spurs game, they didn't have a lot. I think Spurs will outlast them. I just think their legs will go.
But 5th place might be enough anyway.
Could
be enough anyway. Quick check on the situation down the bottom end. Of course, there's been a further points penalty for Nottingham Forest. There's a potential for, in the next week or so, Everton receiving another alteration to their tally from a separate set of profit and sustainability breaches.
Haven't Forest also said they are going to appeal?
They have indeed.
And that means that the scenario in which the season could finish and there's still appeals outstanding, I think now will happen, right?
I don't know, Benji.
No, I'm pretty sure it now makes that entirely possible.
Okay.
Yeah.
As it stands, barely worth me even reading this out, but as it stands, Blades are bottom. They're 8 points off safety. They do have a game in hand, but that really only matters if you can win games, which they're not traditionally very good at. Feels like there's not a PSR penalty big enough to save Sheffield United. Burnley maybe are a different kettle of fish. They're second last, but after that minus four for Forest, they're 5 points from safety.
And they've just beaten Brentford, which is the first victory in quite a long time. And the gap is only 5 points.
Yeah.
And with the potential for further points deductions, I think that that victory against Brentford could, you know, could it prove a platform? I mean, probably not. Certainly not. But, you know, who knows?
Burnley 19th in 18th place are Nottingham Forest. Just a point behind Luton on the right side of the dotted line. Then you've got Everton, who are 4 points from the drop, but with another potential penalty on the way. They do have a game in hand, the Toffees.
11 games without a win now, Everton in the league.
Games. And then above them are Brentford, who have a 5-point cushion over the bottom three, but they also have 1 point from their last five games, no wins since the 10th of February, and Man United visiting on Saturday. Is this going to be more bad news for Brentford, or is it going to be that time when Man United turned up in the green kits and with a team featuring, who was in it, Ronaldo and Sancho and Fred and stuff?
It's amazing that's only last season. That feels so long ago.
Brentford absolutely smashed them, 4-0.
Yeah, Brentford are weird. Like, they've... against the biggest teams, they often change their formation and make themselves really hard to play against. I mean, you saw they very nearly got a point at the Emirates in that game a few weeks ago.
I think Pinnock's back.
Yeah.
Makes a big difference.
Yeah, it's tricky to say. Like, I think you can say with confidence this will be a very difficult game for United. But United have won a lot of games this season, including the home game against Brentford where they scored two goals in stoppage time.
Right.
So it's just whether they're able to kind of scrape through and dig out a win.
United coming off that 4-3 victory over Liverpool, of course, prior to the break.
Which, you know, in a different context, you might say, well, that's the kind of result, the kind of performance that you could really build on. But you can't, because it was just such a completely ridiculous game that United were not in control of at any time. I think that the positive sort of impact that result has had is more to do with sort of the mood around the club, because they're, you know, for good reason, there's been a lot of negativity around United this season, but that was a real win for the ages, quashed, you know, Liverpool's quadruple push as Jurgen Klopp embarks on his farewell tour. And again, it was the youngsters who were
good for the vibes. Everton, as you mentioned, 11 games without a win. They at 3 o'clock go to Bournemouth, who also aren't in the best of form, and Bournemouth is Sean Dyche's favourite opponent. He's beat them 8 times in the Premier League. That's significant. Yeah, big week this for Everton. As we mentioned, more penalties perhaps on the way. Chelsea are up against Burnley. If Burnley are going to work a great escape, an upset here would be a pretty nice way to get that thing underway. It did finish actually 1-1, this fixture at the Bridge last season. That's taking place at 3 o'clock, as is Forest against Crystal Palace. And Sheffield United against the aforementioned Fulham. Wow. Very nice.
Very meaty Saturday, isn't it? So one of the meatiest Saturdays of the entire season. You kind of want that. You know, we've been starved of Prem for a while. Yeah. You want a really all-day football.
Yeah, it's true.
Fill your boot.
And then there's a midweek round as well.
Oh, like, yeah.
Overload.
Mm. Woo!
We're going to be quite literally injecting the Premier League straight into our veins
for
the next week.
As you say.
And beyond. Literally.
As you said. Very good. A reminder that Tom's book Va Va Voom is available on April the...
By the way, can I just say, I've just spotted the quotes from the front of his beautiful book. So we've got, first of all, from the esteemed Simon Cooper, excellent.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing this in order. From Glenn Hoddle, fabulous.
Yeah, lovely.
And this I love.
Yeah.
From Christian Carambo, The definitive story.
The definitive story.
It's amazing.
That's a very brief. He could have written this was not... I was expecting the definitive story.
And what was I left with?
Any more Paul quotes?
Who's your forward? Clarence Seydorf.
Oh my goodness, on the back. Jonathan Wilson.
Yeah, Clarence Seydorf did the introduction to his last book.
Oh, he did.
Who wrote the forward on this?
Straight into the prologue. Boom.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to awaying to read my copy of Va Va Voom and perhaps sharing some pictures on Pickfair and reading Charlie Eccleshare on The Athletic. Listen, I don't know what you're going to be doing, but perhaps you'll find time Sunday evening straight Monday morning to join us as we round up all those matches. Great. Have a great time in the meanwhile. Many thanks, Benji and Tom and Charlie and Liam and guest producer Ben, old school, in the booth. And you, listener, we'll be back with you soon. For now, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.